Survivor Specialist John and McKenna are back, and as always with this series, we are joined by Kyle of the Matt Chat. No, not Tagless Matt Chat, the Matt Chat. And today we have a very special guest. It is Alex Trias. You've seen him on the podcast a few times here and there, covering for either John and I on the Rewind. He also, you might look familiar because he podcasted a lot over on Reality After Show. Their name anymore. They've changed so many times, covering the challenge. But he's also a longtime patron over here at The Specialist. So we're like, you know what? Let's bring you on, take you out of your podcast hiatus, and talk about some first jurors.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this because, like, honestly, because of my entry point to Survivor, these are essentially five of the first seven seasons I've ever watched live.
That's wild.
Perfect.
So a great time for me to come in.
Yes. Yes. So this week we are talking Ghost Island, David versus Goliath, Edge of Extinction, Island of the Idols, and Winners at War. So let's get into it with Ghost Island. The man, the myth, the legend, Chris Noble, is our first juror. And I mean, we hit it off with a bang here with our first one to talk about today. It is the Dom versus Chris show the entire way through, and through this episode, he is very prominent. He is the opposition to Dom and Wendell, and it's almost a shame that he's the first juror because he is so prevalent throughout the season, but it makes for a beautiful send-off here in his vote-out episode. So Alex, talk about your thoughts on Chris.
Chris is sort of like that iconic style of the merch boot that, like, I feel like in the past you became more known of. It's like they became a big deal because they became the lead person on a jury. Like, obviously the format's different in these seasons, but even in this season, like, we'll get to it later. I'm like, I think he does actually a very good job in his role afterwards. As a player, oh, I loved him. He's everything you wanted in, like, a chaos agent. You get some drama. Like, guys, I'm challenge coded. Like, you're giving me him versus Dom. Dom ends up on the challenge. Like, this was his practice here. I was like, Chris is just, like, authentically him, for better or worse. So I sort of loved the main character energy he provided. And you sort of get this essence throughout this episode of... The producers knew that too.
Yeah, Chris Noble is one of my favorite characters of all time, and this episode is really like his episode, you know. And I agree, I love the main character energy that he brings, and I think we got it for just the right amount of time here. But what I like about Chris is that it might sound weird to say, but he's kind of a gamer. Like, he respects the game, right? Yeah. He's a goof in the game, but like, he goes against Dom the whole time, but then he votes for Dom at the end. He doesn't hold a grudge. He says good game. And he's one of Dom's biggest champions on the jury. And it reflects in the vote count, which we'll probably talk about at some point, but I think that Chris is really important here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree, Kyle. One of the most important things about Chris Noble, just completely in the entire pantheon of Ghost Island in general, is he kind of represents something we don't normally see in a Survivor season. And that is a direct opposition to our antagonist. Like, he is a foil to the protagonist that we have for the season. I might have said antagonist. I'm not protagonist.
No, you said it right.
You know what? Dom might be considered an antagonist. Anyways, point being is...
Don't ask him.
We have... The way the season's framed, we do have two major focal points of the season in Dom and Wendell. The entire season is framed around that, mostly because of how the season ends with the tie vote. It really is trying to frame it in a way where you think either of these two could win the season. But what Chris Noble presents is the great obstacle these two need to get over in order to take control of the season that they do in the post-merge. So what we really get from him is this strange place where he almost... Despite the fact that he's in opposition. He doesn't come off as a villain necessarily. He's not like your prototypical villain, I guess is what I'm trying to say, right? Like, he's not like the big bad from like a fantasy movie or something like that. Like, this isn't your Sauron. This isn't your like Emperor Palpatine or anything like that. This is more of a, it's more like if we're looking at a sports movie, he's that guy from the rival team who, you know, is really antagonistic and then like turns over and helps out the team at the end.
He's Zach from Wedding Crashers.
He's to go with some of the patron content. He's Flash Thompson in Spider-Man.
Yeah, kind of. I don't think he's quite
like maybe modern Flash Thompson, where it's like it's a little more bravado. It's not like necessarily meant to be purely antagonistic, but what you do does great on others, including the people that are more focal to the story.
I think like Flash Thompson feels a little too friendly with Peter Parker, and honestly, for the analogy I'm going for, it's I'm thinking of more like, oh, I can't even think off the top of my head what I'm trying to say right now, because I went down like a Beyblade anime rabbit hole recently, and that's all I can think of.
We gotta
demolition noise and stuff in the third
season. We're losing McKenna here. We're losing
nerd hole. We gotta regroup. Survivor nerd hole. But
this is exactly what it is, though. Is like Chris Noble plays this role in this season, and that is unlike anything we really see in any first year we've talked about so far. Mm-hmm. He is the pinnacle of obstacle for our protagonists of the season, the two people we are primarily following throughout the entire thing. And his decision should end up being the focal point of the season. And the fact that it doesn't become that is so fascinating.
And with Chris, I believe Damon Wendell when he wasn't supposed to be that first juror, and Chris kind of just threw that conversation to the wayside, thinking that they were trying to dupe him, which valid because they haven't worked together the entire season. But at the same time, you know, that group was all about Navidi Strong. And at least for the merge vote, I'd believe that, even if I wasn't working with them the entire time, and then I would make my turn, because then I'm not going to be that person that gets hit first. Because if I'm Chris, I know I'm up on the chopping block if I, you know, throw a plan that's, you know, getting Dom or Wendell out, or, you know, lead everybody in the entire camp to the well to go talk about the plan.
I don't know. Because like I tried putting myself in his shoes. I rewatched all the merge episodes, and I was just like, from Chris's perspective, one, I don't think you needed, I understand why they wanted to have Dom in the conversation. I don't think you needed Dom there.
Wendell,
I think if it was just Wendell and Chris, I think Chris potentially can be more receptive to it. But because he's already has his walls up against Dom so hard, that no matter what Dom says, no matter how he does, the little bit of inflection in his voice will make Chris go, he's trying to play me. It does not matter here. Like, it doesn't even matter if they actually do go for Libby here. Chris could be thinking, okay, we go for Libby, and then they're just going to go for me next, and I just lost someone that I could have used to get them out. Mm-hmm. Like, this is where, like, when John's saying, like, he's this fascinating character, it's like, because he gives all the impressions of a recruit. Of like someone who's never seen the show before, but also is giving all the energy of wanting to have control and play the game, not just I am here to enjoy the ride. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where, like, even when you have the power brokers come together, he's like, this is all nice and all, but I want to be the head honcho. Like, I don't want to play with you guys. I want to be better than you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he wants all the glory, and we see that in his trip to Ghost Island when he gets the JT idol, risks it. He wins one and then loses the second time, right? So, and then it's only good for two tribals. He knows his name is coming up at this tribal and then doesn't play it. So, yeah, it's like he is going for it all, right? He's not planning to work with Dom and Wendell one vote. Or two votes, right? He is looking to win the game or lose the game right here.
Yeah. Yeah. And him, you know, trying to navigate some of this, and where I think it's interesting that he votes for Dom and, you know, plays in a way that, you know, you were talking about, Alex, of like, is he a recruit or does he want to be here? Because I think if it was a recruit, they're voting for Wendell here, where even though like Dom is his direct opposition and Wendell's just the guy going along with Dom in Chris's head, he still gives Dom the nod, even though Dom was, you know, that one of those big forces of let's get out Chris, and Wendell is more of the, hey, what if we keep him in a little bit longer and kind of vouching a bit more for Chris. And he still gives that nod to Dom because, you know, Dom is that force for him. And I think that's great to have in a first juror where they can really reflect and be like, you know what? You know, this guy got me. I was trying to get him and he did it. And that's not always the case with our first jurors. That's why we call this bitter or better, because they do have those, you know, bitter moments. And for me, Chris Noble, better.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I think one of the interesting things to take into consideration when it comes to Chris Noble is, like, everything you guys are saying, but like, Chris Noble is a recruit. Like, we know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. He is a recruit. And because of that, I think why he leans more Dom in this situation, again, it kind of goes back to what we've been talking about a lot in the series of the jury wants to vote for their proxy out of the finalists, right? Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that Dom was his direct opposition, the reason these two clash so much is because of how similar they were.
Yeah.
Right? They were two alpha dogs vying for control of this game. Dom just had the better partner, by which I mean a actual partner to work with, that helped propel him through there. And I think what's so fascinating about the fact that this jury splits exactly halfway through it, right? The first five jurors end up voting. It is five, right? Four?
Five.
First five jurors vote for Dom. The last five vote for Wendell, forcing Laurel to cast this tying vote. I think this really is more indicative of what we see from Dom, right? Like, because we know for a fact the way that Dom treated Sebastian on his way out of the game really soured a lot of the jury. And this is one of those things where the people, this is going to sound a little crazy, but let's go back to Thailand for a minute.
Always.
Because it's very similar to what we see in Thailand, where the first half of the jury votes for Clay and the second half votes for Brian. And a lot of it has to do with how grading someone can be the longer you spend with them.
Mm-hmm.
And while Chris is there seeing this proxy of himself in Wendell and really, you know, advocating and likely talking to these first five jurors and Libby and Desiree and Jenna and Michael about, you know, Dom's so impressive. It's this weird, like, alpha male thing where they're in total conflict, but they all, like, love each other a lot. It's weird. It's just, like, jockey bro culture, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it's not a surprise that he would go this way. But the longer these people spent time with these people, the more that type of personality really grated on them. And I think that's why we end up seeing this split in this journey.
There's something else here that we're going to see, like, from some of the first jurors later on here, where there's this emphasis of, like, when you're the first juror asking, like, the finalists of, don't bullshit us, like, we need authentic answers. And there's a degree here where I'm watching Chris, like, actually genuinely wanting to hear both of them, like, become alpha in a sense. And when I think he loses Wendell, he's already leaning Dom. I think he loses Wendell when Wendell makes the pitch that, yo, if you would have just, like, agreed with us, you would have been sitting right here with us. And he's like, no. That wasn't going to happen, because I know I wasn't going to let that happen. So it's like, it further puts himself in that Dom spot, because Dom's just being, I think he sees, like you said, John, like, Dom's being everything that he would have wanted to be if he was at final tribal council. Be loud, be in, like, a little in your face about it, but, like, being authentic. And I think that was surprisingly something that was very big for Chris in this season, was, like, he wasn't really that much of a bullshitter, you know? he sort of just kept it how it is. And it was like, if I don't like you, you'll know I don't like you. And I will most likely vote for you to go home. But if you get me, you get me.
Yeah, I was going to talk about, you know, his jump in for Final Tribal Council, because obviously, like, in the with this new jury format, it's you have the outwit, outplay, outlast segments, and either a few of these first jurors don't speak, or they have the "we're all still open" and "congratulations, everybody" speech. But he says, "You gotta tell me who the real mastermind is. And someone bury the other person so we aren't splitting votes," because he's trying to get to the bottom of this game so this tie doesn't happen. But
so much for that.
Still, I mean, it still inevitably does, but yeah. Anything else on Chris, guys?
I mean, I kind of want to dissect this wording that Chris has for this question, though, right? Like, it again does have this like aggressive alpha male nature to it, where it doesn't sound like he wants one of them to differentiate themselves from each other. He wants them to stop being so friendly with each other.
Yeah.
Is the problem, right? Like, and I think that is one of the things that really it propels Wendell to his win here, is the fact that he is a friendly person, right? Like, it is his social game that ends up getting him Laurel's vote in the end, the deciding vote in the tie. But I think this is almost like a detrimental question to Dom, because it would have turned more people off of Dom if he had just like completely buried Wendell here.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's pivot over to David versus Goliath. We have Elizabeth as our first juror. Elizabeth had been rubbing a few people the wrong way in the pre-merge. Few people weren't getting along with her, and she became just the consensus vote that the Davids were willing to vote out, and the Goliaths were only voting for a David. And so the Davids kind of just offered up Elizabeth because Elizabeth wasn't really in any of their inner workings. So they were kind of just on that back foot and were just like, all right, we're okay with Elizabeth, and then let's kind of regroup here.
Yeah, it sort of goes with the season. And you really see it with the game plan. It's like the game continues to go on. It's like all these people are very willing to adapt. And it's the, at least in the short term, it's the ones who choose like to be so definitively like, I am only in this box and I will not go outside of this box to play with anyone else, are the ones who end up like ultimately suffering. So it's like, because Elizabeth, you even hear it in her final words, it's just like, I wanted David to win. I only want to work with the Davids. I'll pull a Glive over just for the sake of having the Davids start to gain the numbers, essentially. It's like, there's no reflexive like play here of, I want to expand and work with both sides so that not only can I be safe now because my name's out, but I can be safe in future rounds. There wasn't a lot of like forward thinking there, where you see other people making moves, making deals during this time period where they're allowing Elizabeth to go because they have more important things to do than just focus on, oh, we gotta keep a David, oh, we gotta keep a Goliath.
Yeah, this is the most like no man's land of all the merge votes here. Like, Elizabeth was really just on her own. And and like she says in her jury question or her jury sentence, cut the crap, right? Like, she is not a bullshitter. And I think that that's a tone that she sets here, because on her way out, she has, you know, her whole thing with Angelina, and Angelina is trying to do jury management, and like, you know, Angelina's full of shit, and Nick is not really like that. You know, he plays, you know, he lies in the game and can be manipulative, but like, he's not that kind of person. And I think Elizabeth was looking for that type of person to vote for. And so that's a really important tone to set, or have a tone set for you in Nick's case.
Okay, I'm going to go off for a minute. So if you want to like jump in first, feel free to.
I can't wait to hear this.
I don't have like much more to say on Elizabeth, but she, you know, like Kyle was saying, is that no man's land kind of just character here. And there was a potential for Christian to go out if they were trying to get that big move going, but it was really only Angelina pushing that. And I just want to commend Elizabeth for her drive, determination, and love for the game, because that was very apparent throughout this entire episode. She wasn't going to go down without a fight, and she went out kicking and screaming, especially in that tribal council. And yes, she did want a David to win, so that kind of taints her view as a first juror for me. If she, you know, didn't say that in her final words, I'd give her more along the lines of a better first juror, but I think she was only going in voting for a David.
Yeah, I agree. And this is where I'm going to have a soapbox about, like, viewing for a season. We have a couple of controversial seasons coming up in Edge of Extinction and Winners of War, just because of, like, the formatting of this season. I don't like versus seasons. Specifically because they really predetermine, they put in these notions of people working against each other. And when we look at these seasons, you generally see people succeed when they can get over those type of titles and work together with people. You look at something like Ko Rong, which has a lot of mishing and mashing of those groups, but you still have, like, the brains on the outside for the most part in that entire season. Or, like, one of the three groups tends to be shifting to the outside in that. In Millennials versus Gen X, right? Like, we have that Millennials versus Gen X divide. It kind of breaks down a bit, but it still, like, rears its head every once in a while. But it's not as bad as David versus Goliath. David versus Goliath was so... it's just such a charged subject, right? Because of the way that storytelling works. Storytelling, you always want, like, for the most part, people like rooting for an underdog. They like rooting for the David in any situation, right? Like that, and this season itself perfectly puts them into a situation where a David should win. Like, the theme wants you to vote for a David. The way the season plays out makes the Davids even more rootable. We go into the merge. They've already been, like, mixing and matching. We've seen, like, one of the Goliaths come over to the Davids with Alec flipping over and everything. However, you get to the merge. What's the split between Goliaths and Davids at the merge? It's 7 Goliaths and 6 Davids. The Davids are automatically on the outs because the Goliaths have all come back together. The only logical thing for the Davids to do in this situation is to agree with the Goliaths and vote Elizabeth out here. And then, you know, we get, like, the tools and everything that come, all the advantages that happen, that kind of fall into the Davids' laps because they were working hard and getting them, right? Yeah. Like, obviously, I'm not saying, like, they were given to them intentionally. It happened to be the story falls out that way. But then look at this final tribal council. You then have a final tribal council where you have one David and 2 Goliaths. And all of a sudden, that advantage that Goliath had at the merge is flipped, and the Davids now have the majority on that jury.
That's true. And then, I mean, we are all, you are all rooting for the David, and it does hurt this season, I guess, in a vote perspective, because how did a David, Nick, get that far? But at the same time, those three were all on Jebeni together. So, like, there is an alliance that actually happened, but it just happened to be with 2 Goliaths, which very much played out in Nick's favor to be able to be like, hey, other Davids, I got here somehow, and to get to pull in some of their votes.
Well, and let's say you even had it where it was, like, 2 Davids and a Goliath there. You run this issue with this theme of how, like, they want to carry themselves. Davids are going to want to vote for a Davids. It's the hero's effect of heroes versus villains. Yeah. Like, the hero wants to vote for the person who's most a hero. The villains don't care about being a villain and being identified as a villain and voting for the person who most reflects the villain. The same thing goes with a Goliath. Like,
true.
I don't think there's a world where John or Dan vote for any of the Goliaths if they go out being betrayed by the Goliaths. Like, they're not going to go, like, oh, I want to have the most Goliath person win because that reflects me. They're going to be bitter, and they're going to be F you. Yeah. I'm going to vote for Nick because I'm giving him the credit for the move that most likely other people also did, but I'm giving him the credit for it.
Mm-hmm. And again, I think it goes into the theming of the season, though, right? Because, like, I think a Goliath commends that type of gameplay, right? Like, I think, like, naturally the term Goliath will respect someone who forces themselves into a game and pushes the things out. I do think it is, like you said, again, like, these three were all in Chobani together. Clearly there's an alliance, and I think it's very apt that the alliance that crossed these predefined titles given to them at the beginning of the game is the one that's able to work the best throughout the season. I think there is a reason for that. But I think, like, Goliaths are going to prop that up, where Davids are kind of more, because it's the underdog thing, and just the way society goes, right? Davids are more likely to rile around each other and lift each other up, just like from a stereotypical standpoint.
Yeah. And we were talking about this a bit more with the fans versus favorite seasons of, like, maybe we do want a favorite actually as the first juror and not a fan, because they'll be able to control my jury a bit more. And I think that's the same thing with Nick. Was he thinking about that at the time of booting Elizabeth? No, probably not. But as it gets going, oh, I have a David as my first juror. That can only help me. As if I had a Goliath, it might, you know, there might be a little bit more of that tumultuous, you know, maybe more hostile jury, depending on who is that Goliath that gets, you know, put in that first juror spot. So I feel like having Elizabeth, even though she was, you know, one of the more vocal, boisterous Davids, that still helps, you know, Nick out in the long run of having her as the first juror.
I would have been curious to see if one of these other Goliaths had made it to the end, if, like, Kara or Allison had made it to the end. And seeing what their pitch was like, and say, like, just because I'm a Goliath doesn't mean that, like, you know, I didn't face hardships in this game, or like this and that, or if it was an all Goliath final three, I would be very interested to see how the Davids on the jury would have approached voting for that. And sometimes it just has to do with, like we're talking about, the story, the way things play out, because we saw a contender get demolished by a champion in a final tribal council, an Australian survivor. So I think it just has to do with, like, the group. Like, if Carl had made it to the end, is Carl commanding this type of respect's the wrong word, because, of course, but, like, you know, would his game be looked at as that great? I think sometimes it just depends on who that person is, and things just fell exactly this right way for Nick.
Yeah, and it's who you're there at the end with. So like, even if I would personally say, spoiler alert, I think Elizabeth is a bitter juror. But
I would also say the same thing of, like, I think she's along the lines of leans more bitter than necessarily better, even though it works out for Nick.
But sort of, I give it credit to being, like, I have this thing where it's like, there's a justifiability of bitterness. Mm-hmm. Where, like, for example, I would not have been surprised if Chris Noble was bitter at Dom, so he voted for Wendell, because the actions within the game matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what Elizabeth leaves with, Angelina maybe trying to be genuine, Elizabeth doesn't take it as genuine. It's sort of like, this is sort of disrespectful that, like, you're telling me to my face right before we go, like, thank you for letting me know I'm leaving, but, like, oh, you're not gonna, like, not vote for me, like, you're gonna vote me out, even though you're sad that you're voting me out. Like, cool, thanks. I'm not going to vote for you ever. And then there's the, you know, there's the gray area that people have with Mike on, like, how much of a factor was his, what he is known to be outside, and how much he has outside influencing your vote. Because we do get three people voting for him, two Goliaths, and then we have Christian vote for Mike. Because Christian decides that he thinks Mike has the most impressive game. Mm-hmm. But you have all these people. I can see Elizabeth being someone who's like, I will never vote for Mike because I want to give someone who needs the money.
Mm-hmm.
So not David, even so much as the title of
Survivor.
So you're going to give it to the David.
Yeah. Even though he's a lawyer. But, yes. Yeah, and then during
I actually think you kind of hit the nail on the head of like something that like kind of sucks with this season. It's like it is so arbitrary because Nick is a lawyer.
Yeah, this is a very successful final for
it. Nick isn't a David in the sense of like.
And then if you go to Final Four, Kara's a very successful real estate agent.
Yeah, we have a, and then a doctor.
Allison's a doctor. And then a doctor. So, you know, let's redo this season and get David to be the David.
It's not like we have like dreams on this season, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Like,
right.
No. Like they didn't really, they just like threw it. Honestly, people give Game Changers a flack for like title, but David versus Goliath is the only reason you're not giving David versus Goliath a like the flack it deserves for this theming is because you like the season.
Right. Christian is a successful professor at a university for robotics. And like, you're a David because you wear silly t-shirts.
Yeah.
Hat was really the most David of the Davids.
Absolutely. And then you get him out of there right away.
That's what caused the season from happening.
I mean, you could argue Jessica Pete doesn't have much in her pockets. She's 19.
I don't think
you're I don't know her family.
I roll at that age. I think what really like it comes down to here. I think the thing with Elizabeth is she bitter? Is she better? I don't know. All I know is she hates lazy people and stupid people.
I love seeing that again in the merge episode.
She didn't have much participate in Final Tribal Council either. She just did the, you know, congrats. We're undecided and cut the crap and be authentic. So she kind of has a nothing burger FTC too.
Yeah. Before we move on, just genuine question during this time period of Survivor. Is production pointing a gun at them? Like, what? We are undecided. Raise your hand if you're undecided. Every single person raises their hand. I'm sorry. We know that's not how this works.
That's TV.
I know, but that doesn't work. I'm more impressed if someone says, I came with my mind decided and you changed it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Instead of being like, we're up in the air. I'm really voting for Nick and not voting for these two at all. But I'm so up in the air about this. It's just that part of me I always lose. I know it's a TV thing, but I'm like, you can miss me with this. Tell me the truth. You tell me the truth. You're telling them to tell the truth. Tell me the truth.
One thing I love about summer is how easy everything feels. The days are a little more relaxed, and I find myself reaching for the same comfortable go-anywhere pieces again and again. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on well-made essentials that naturally become those everyday staples you actually live in all season long.
Quince's 100% European linen pants and shirts are breathable, easy to throw on, and a summer upgrade your rotation needs. Starting at just $34. And Phil, I told you this before, but I don't often wear linen shirts or linen pants. But now that I have them from Quince, I find myself going back to them time and time again, whether it's an upscale outdoor event or if I'm just hanging by the beach or at the pool, I'm reaching for these shirts all throughout the summer. Also, their tees are soft enough to live in all day, and the lightweight cotton sweaters are exactly what you want when summer nights cool down. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen. So you're paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a trusted favorite for everything from home to travel to everyday essentials.
Make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/specialist for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/specialist with an S at the end for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/specialists. Your paycheck date could soon become the most irrelevant number in your life. Earnin is a non-bank finance app, 5 million people and growing. The concept is almost annoyingly simple. You earn money, you access it. Up to $150 per day of what you've already worked for, up to $1,000 between paychecks. Tips are optional and standard transfers take 1 to 2 business days with no mandatory fees. Expedited transfers start at $3.99 and cap at $5.99. It's not about emergencies. It's just a better way to exist financially day to day. Worth checking out. Look, you all know I wear a lot of hats, and nothing annoys me more than waiting for money that I earned while due dates inch closer and closer. I did the work, so what's taking so long? We live in an era of instant gratification. So why don't we demand instant access to our money? The most essential thing we need to participate in society is the thing we wait for the most. That's absurd. End the absurdity today. Download EarnIn on the App Store or Google Play, spelled like earning money without the G. Type in the specialist under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Access limits are based on your earnings and risk factors. Standard cash outs take 1 to 2 business days with no mandatory fees. Expedited transfers available for a fee. Tips are voluntary and don't affect the service. Available in select states. Terms and restrictions apply. Visit EarnIn.com for full details.
All right, we are moving on to Edge of Extinction now. Reem is our first. It was weird to watch two premieres as our first-year episodes with Reem and then in a little bit Amber. But, man, I love Edge of Extinction. And Reem defines the bitter category. Granted, she has nobody else to vote for, really. Like, Chris, who is she going to vote for in that final three? She never met anybody, so obviously she's going Chris. But she, as everybody joins the Edge, she interrogates them. She is like, why did you vote for me? And this place is gonna suck. Just wait. Like, she is the definition of bitter and kind of curmudgeon-y. But also, we see in this episode, she can be that mother, endearing, wants to help out. So Reem is just a paradox of a first juror here, because while, you know, she'll take no shit, she'll still listen to you.
It's one of the few reasons I like The Edge, and few is putting it very nicely.
I remember watching, right now.
I'm not putting it on trial, but I can have my opinion that I don't like the twist. However, with the twist being a thing in this season, I remember watching this live, and I actually was so thankful that this was a thing that existed, because so many times you have these people who I think are iconic. Reem is an iconic first boot, like, and they give her the edit of one, and I love it, but there's all this time where you're like, I wish I could see more from these people. And this is where, like, The Edge is good. Like, you get to have the opportunity to see these people get more fleshed out. And, like, while, yes, we continue to see Reem just be bitter and depressed, honestly, for the remainder of her days on The Edge, in a weird way, I'm thankful for it, because it allowed her to be here and get, like, a full experience. Mm-hmm. Even though she never meets two of the final three, ever.
Yeah.
In this game.
Yeah, Reem is the perfect person to be at Edge of Extinction first, because, like, even when Chris, the person that she votes for, gets there, she's like, oh, your kind isn't welcome here, dude. Like, it's so funny to watch that interaction, and this is I really don't know if she was happy to vote for Chris or not, to be honest with you. I think she probably was. Because, you know, Chris, he really uses his time on Edge of Extinction wisely and to his benefit, should he come back into the game, and it works for him here. But yeah, it's so odd for the first juror, the person setting the tone, is someone who went to one tribal council, didn't meet half the cast, and really had no idea what was going on in the game on a day-to-day basis. So this is the most unique situation to me of anything that we're going to talk about in this series.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, I'm going to start off by saying, if Reem Daly has one fan or has no fans, then I'm dead. Like, I love Reem. Reem is an incredible, incredible addition to the Survivor pantheon. And I think what she brings to this season is that bitterness. I'm going to skip to it right now. Reem is bitter, but not in the same way that every other bitter juror is.
Yeah. Because
Reem is bitter throughout the entire game, and we see her go through 36 days of being bitter as she gets to the end of the game to finally cast a vote for the winner of this season. But what she does, like you said, Kyle, she is the perfect first boot of this season, because she honestly, upon rewatching the premiere for Edge of Extinction, I did a season rewatch quite recently. Reem doesn't, like, Reem in the premiere is not Reem we see for the rest of the season.
Right.
Reem the Premier is this like very motherly character just trying to take care of everyone, but then they vote her out and like the switch flips. Except she's still like this very endearing character throughout there, really struggling with the fact that she's been voted out. And why I think she's so important and why ultimately like she votes for Chris. Yes, like she probably got close to Chris on that long time that they spent together in the game. But also, this is one of those things where like the theme of Edge of Extinction, someone from the Edge of Extinction has to be able to win. And the jury has to be able to consider someone from Edge of Extinction to be able to win. Otherwise, there's no point in someone coming back from the Edge of Extinction.
Yeah.
And,
Sorry, continue.
And because of that, what I think Reem really does see is Chris coming back into the game and playing this perfect game. Yes, he had a blueprint to finish the game and like what he had to do. The point of the matter is like he had to do it. But what Chris really represents for Reem is justification for the suffering she went through for the 36 days she spent on the Edge.
Yeah, I mean, her final words are, "No offense, but screw my tribe. You're mad that I put your freaking clothes on the beach to dry? Whatever. And I don't want to cry because I'm still in the game and I'm happy to be in the game, but it's wet and cold. I just got to stick it out. Edge of freaking extinction." She, like, just from those final words, you can tell she ticked some people off and is bitter about it, but also is sensitive and endearing and loves the game of Survivor.
Yeah, and she's not the only bitter juror on this jury, I don't think. Like, Eric, Julia, Ron Clark to a certain extent. Like, this is another example.
Victoria?
Yeah, well, right.
Yeah, the Victoria vote's crazy.
Yeah. This is another example where, like, the second half, not the second half of the jury, but people towards the end of the jury vote for one person, and the beginning of the jury is voting for another person, because the first six jurors vote for Chris. Eight of the first nine jurors vote for Chris. So it is like the people who spent more time on the Edge of Extinction are voting for that person, like the person we've talked about, their proxy, right? The person that they see themselves in. And then, you know, Lauren, like, she didn't go to Edge of Extinction, like, she the whole game. And she has no reason to be bitter. But when you're living on the island and you have to think about all these people who just voted you out, like, it does create a bitter environment. And so Reem was obviously like the most bitter. She, you know, was the loudest, but the environment definitely fosters a more bitter jury. And I think that's reflected in a lot of these votes.
It's sort of like the issue with these casts, or not these casts, like the jury size. Because like even before you add Edge of Extinction, where like in the theory, everyone gets to be on the jury by playing the season. Whereas like, you even see it in like 10, like we get a lot more 10-0 votes like in the 30s because you just get into this point of groupthink where you end up being like, we want the people at the beginning are loud, so like, I want this person to win. And then eventually everyone else is just like, yeah, I just don't care that much, so I'll go with you. Or they don't want to be that one person who, like, oh, I'm going to vote this other way. And then it becomes 9-1-0 and everyone's going to be like, you're dumb. Why didn't you vote for Adam, who clearly should win? I like that we get out of that in the new era, but like, it's something that really comes up here where I'm like, if you just cut this jury in half and you actually have just like a realistic jury, like Chris still wins based off the votes, but you have more back and forth here because it's less time that people are just sitting there stewing over whatever happened in the game on day 13, on day 6, on day 18. Instead, it's a lot more close. So you have fresh feelings. You understand what's going on.
Yeah. And she spent the most time with Chris, and I don't think she even influenced the jury because she spent the most time with Chris, because they also spent a lot of time with Chris. And then when that starts to flip over to Gavin is when those people are starting to spend more time with Gavin than they would with Chris on Edge of Extinction too. They see more of Gavin's gameplay and less of, you know, what Chris is doing on Edge of Extinction, especially the people who get voted out after Chris is back.
Right. Yeah, it's really tough to really contextualize this, because in all honesty, someone coming back from the Edge could have that left that bitterness against that person. Mm-hmm. I think it is really impressive that Chris is able to pull this off. Yes, he has this strategic advantage, but because like we're dealing with a season with 13 of 14 were applicants for this season.
Yeah.
Right? And then we have four returnees. Like, you're dealing with a lot of people who really respect the Game of Survivor.
Who is the...
Reem is the only question mark. So we're not even sure if she's a recruit or not. She's just a question mark.
I think she's applied.
For 20 years.
Yeah. So
everybody.
We're dealing with an entire cast that really respect the game. So the thought of someone coming back into the game and winning could be considered sacrilege for a lot of these people. But it's still not. And I think does come down to Reem as the first person there. Mm. And the person who is laughing in people's faces as they get eliminated and reaming them out, you know, in place of a better word, as soon as they get there, and making them realize kind of like the hubris in their ways that resulted in her going home first, and how it is comical that she is now the one sitting there at the end, or sitting there welcoming them as they also followed her to the Edge.
But to your point, though, about like it being sacrilege, even especially from the return standpoint, you brought up a good point earlier. And I'm like, I've been thinking about it, I'm like, you're right. It's like, while technically, yes, in theory, Gavin should have just won because he actually outlasts everyone. Like, by voting for Chris, you could argue that you're ignoring one third of the game. Even though you could also claim, because of Edge of Extinction, he did outlast. Even though he got voted out, he outlasted everyone who else got the chance to compete in the Edge of Extinction part of the game. It's no different than we live in a world where one immunity challenge away, Ozzy wins South Pacific after being eliminated three times. Because he played the Redemption Island game.
Yeah
exactly.
And that win wouldn't have been as reviled as Chris Underwood's would have.
That's exactly why he's our number 40.
But I think like, another thing to consider, I think now because we have a soapbox to talk about Edge of Extinction on it for a little while, I think one of the important things, you've brought up a really good point here, Alex, where you kind of have to view Edge of Extinction as another tribe in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, you're not voting people out of the game, but
voting people to it.
Yeah, but you're also like, people quit the Edge of Extinction.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is an aspect of this season that, sure, it might not be the most loved, but it is an aspect that has to be considered. And when you look at the Edge of Extinction as a tribe, they still have to play a social game in order to get these jury votes. Sure, they get a bit of an advantage there, but they also can't claim strategic prowess like someone like, you know, the strategic maneuvering that Gavin has throughout the game.
Right.
They can't. Mm-hmm. And even like challenge wins and stuff, right? Chris wins a total of one challenge the entire season. Two challenges, because he wins Final Four immunity and the comeback challenge, and that's it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we see we'll talk about the negative side of the social game when we get to Winners of War when it comes to Edge of Extinction.
Yeah. Because we luckily have two sides of the coin that we're able to talk about it with. But there is one season in between. And that is Island of the Idols. John and I's obligatory one reference into Island of the Idols. And then
every season.
So we are talking about Jack. We are going back to the pre-merge but jury situation here. Which was very strange to me that they put Jack on the jury. But hey, congrats to Jack, because he was also the alternate for the season prior. I think he was the alternate for Edge, and then they put him on IOI. But he's just like kind of there, and he's in a power position. and he's in a duo with Jamal. And then Kelly's like, shall I make a move? I think I shall. Gives an idol to Dean, who then idols out Jack. Her description of why Jack over Jamal is he's good with people. He's empathetic, super fun. She knows that she can trust him, which is strange, but it's not smart to keep him if he's also so well connected with other people as well. So that was her justification. Even if she can trust him, he's still other people must feel the same way that she does. And where does his actual loyalty lie? He does feel like a strange boot, but I think overall a good first juror.
Yes. Good first juror. I think Kelly also would have been a fine first juror in a world where they actually just let it get to a merge before it happened. This season's weird with the one pre-jury, and if he who shall not be named wasn't ejected, we would have had 11 jurors on the season, or if for whatever reason you went to a final two, 12 jurors. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this, they're lucky in that regard that they decided, let's try to mix it up and have a pre- merge person on the jury. But I understood her logic when it came to Jamal and Jack, because like, if you're looking at them as a duo that are, you know, Jamal has a little more control, Jack is more, I would say, the more social one of the two, more affable, more agreeable, it's yes, I trust him, that's gonna make him harder to get taken out as you get further and further into the game, where based off what how people were talking about their relationships with Jamal, Jamal wasn't someone who was just going to shy away and no longer be a an option to get taken out. Like, case in point, he gets taken out two rounds later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't think the same thing happens in a world where they idle out Jamal and Jack's still in the game.
Mm-hmm.
I think you get a completely different boot order.
I think, yeah, I think that they made the right call. I agree with that. Like, I just don't see how you would get the numbers on Jack, you know, so soon. And he's kind of like a free agent at this point in the game. I mean, I don't know how much, I don't have a good read on Jack as like a player or as a juror. I mean, this is bland here, right? Like, or basic, whatever.
Basic.
The one thing that we know about his game, or the one thing I know, is that he thinks honesty would be chill, right? But that is important to note, right? I mean, that doesn't so tell true. You about how it is so true, right? That's what everybody wants. And it tells you a little bit about how Jack is approaching the game, how he's thinking about the game, how he might vote as a juror. And he doesn't really spend a lot of time with any one of these finalists, because you have the original tribes and the swap. So he really only spends like but a week with each of these finalists here. So it's hard to gauge what his influence is, what his opinion is. He's one of the most forgettable players to me. Whenever I I know Survivor players as well as anybody, and I always forget Jack. So his impact doesn't quite stick out here.
Don't tell yourself short. You know Survivor players better than most people, and you can't remember Jack. That says something.
Yeah.
Jack
real.
Kyle just kind of hit the nail on the head. Jack is just like kind of this nothing entity the entire season. The biggest thing you remember about him throughout the entire thing is his relationship with Jamal and the whole like do red conversation that happens. And he's not even like actively involved in that. Right? Like, he isn't actively involved. We have no idea what he's doing. What he ends up doing, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm just double-checking this here. Okay, I am correct. Jack did, at least from being a pre-merge boot, sit or have the final three all have been on a tribe with him. He did actually meet them all.
Yeah.
Prior to, like, being voted out, which is good. And it gives him a better time to evaluate everything. But again, like, we just don't see enough Jack in this season because, quite frankly, the editing on this season is atrocious.
We get a little bit in the
I wonder why.
Is it the king, queen, and the jack?
Yeah.
Like Molly, yeah. Jamal, and Jack.
But he's the least involved in that. Like,
yeah, he, I mean, he's the jack. He's not the king, kind of, queen. Yeah.
He's just kind of put in there. He just like happens to be in there. Again, it's like his relationship with Jamal is the only thing we really have any indication of him there. Mm-hmm. And because of that, and because the editing is so bad because of the Island of Idols, and also the, you know, the other things in this season, but mostly it's because there's a, like this entire segment that doesn't need to be there, that takes up a lot of episodes. And because of that, like, we just don't know Jack. It's really funny because you kind of look at, we talked about Ghost Island already, where that's a season where a lot of people kind of fall through the cracks in the edit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the first juror, Chris Noble, is so pivotal to the storyline.
Right.
That we still know a lot about him. We talked about him for a good, like, 15, almost 20 minutes earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Jack just kind of slips through the cracks and, like, doesn't seem consequential to anything.
Yeah, I think what Ghost Island benefits from is, like, it's a bang-wow premiere, and then you have your other boots, you fall off, then you have a wow merge, then you kind of fall off, and then you have a wow FTC. Mm-hmm. And you don't get that with Island of the Idols. Like, the first juror is a little shocking because it's pre-merge, but it's like, who's the first juror? Oh, yeah, Jack. And then Island of the Idols gets shocking for other reasons that are not necessarily game-related or people try and use it as game material when it shouldn't be. So... it doesn't have that, you know, Chris Noble effect, and he doesn't have that, you know, wow. And there's also not a kind of direct opposition here that we're seeing too. He's not really opposing anybody. He's just riding the wave.
It's sort of the issue of that you see with winner edits of people whose games derive entirely on the social game. Mm-hmm. Jack gets the double whammy of his strength is his social game and, like, just his aptitude to life. It's, like, I think is what makes people like him or see him as a threat. Mm-hmm. And then because it's not a merge episode, there's no reason to really highlight him.
That's
or
true.
Make him more of a focal point. It's just an episode. Mm-hmm. It's just an episode where we're going to shock the viewers at the end to be like, and he's the first juror.
The other problem with his boot episode is he's not getting a focus in that episode because he's the guy who gets idled out, right? The entire focus on that episode is the Kelly Dean dynamic of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And not even at Tribal Council. Tribal Council is the whole thing of it's about Jamal and the women.
Yeah.
And Jack is silent the entire time and just sitting there waiting to be idled out.
And what I do like that Jack is saying in this episode, you gotta like listen real quick, but Jack is the one that says to Jamal, like, hey, let Kelly try fire, she's really good at it. And Jamal's like, well, Kelly, you should do it over here. And I love Jamal, and I forgot about this episode entirely.
Yeah,
I didn't remember him being, you know, this abrasive. I don't know what the best word to describe it is, because he does have such endearing moments throughout the entire season, and he's such a great guy. But then, you know, this episode he's kind of just like in a zone where he's nitpicking a lot. But like, Jack is the one to be like, hey, Jamal, take a chill, why don't you let Kelly do it, she's great. And then she strikes up the fire. Some great moments in this episode.
Yeah, like, for that case, is someone having someone so like nonchalant and relaxing as Jack maybe needed in a season filled with as much tension as IOI?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why I think his boot is rather weird, because you should feel like he should go further because he is, you know, that kind of harmony in such a chaotic season. But chaotic seasons don't like those people. They want to get those people out.
Which is funny because we get a very non-chaotic winner.
That's true. That's true. Any other last thoughts on Jack?
I guess technically I would consider him better, but like...
Basically,
yeah, you don't know.
He's one of our other bees.
Of the two, he's better.
Yes, yeah. Of the two. All right, let's dive into Winners at War, because I feel like this is going to be a longer discussion than even Edge was. But so Winners at War is so wild, because though the first boot is Natalie, like we had in Edge of Extinction, Reem was the first boot, first juror. Natalie then gets back into the game, leaving Amber as the first juror. But Natalie has like put her feelers into every person that has attended, that has gotten to the Edge. Granted, so has Amber, but out of the two, Natalie is the most vocal. And it's just so strange that she then gets put into the final tribal council, and now Amber is this, you know, mayor of the Edge. And the only reason why Amber is on the Edge is because of Boston Rob, and because of Boston Rob's decisions pregame that he didn't let Sandra know that he was going to be on the island. And Sandra's like, well, Amber's got to go because I'm bitter toward that decision. If Boston Rob had told Sandra that he was coming out and broke whatever NDA, you know, you're not supposed to say, then this could be a very different season, and Sandra could be in with the Poker Alliance and, you know, be going further in the game. Who knows? But she just gets robbed in this season of being voted out because of her husband, and she doesn't really even get to play. Though at Tribal Council, she does feel very behind the times, but I don't think it is to the fact that she couldn't learn to catch up.
Yes, and I'm gonna hate everything about this conversation, because I'm someone who, when it comes to All Stars, like I give Amber a little more credit than I think the typical person does. Mm-hmm. For I'm not Blake.
Too.
I'm not Blake. Not putting her at 24, yeah. But like she isn't last. She isn't a bottom tier winner. But the issue with her on this season, and you said it multiple times, it's Boston Rob. She is not there to play the game. She is not there to try to win the game. She is there to help Boston Rob because she knows how much Survivor means to Boston Rob. Mm-hmm. And she's a very good partner in life and cares what her husband wants to do and is passionate about. She is checked out. Not and wasn't going to check in. I think if she came in and was like, it's gonna be cool to play with my husband again, and but I want to prove to everyone that I'm just as hungry as he is and I can win a season like this, I don't think she goes out first. I think she has a very tough road ahead of her, but I think there was paths where she wasn't just going to be an inevitability and a project of this is what it is because you're connected to Boston Rob through life.
Mm-hmm. It's we have an odd circumstance here where the first boot / first juror is also one of the finalists. You know, we're never going to see that again. But Amber is
you don't know that.
Yeah, you don't know. It's the only
that when it happens again.
All three of us just go, you don't know.
But yeah, Amber is she's like you said, she's checked out, she's not in the game, she's not really, you know, she's half a participant in the game, really. And she sticks it out on Edge of Extinction, which is great, right? And so she is on
join her too far later from when
this is true, yeah. Now this is I wonder if they should have actually put Rob and Amber on the same tribe to start this season. I know why you would split them up, but I think that it would have been far more interesting to actually put them together. And let's say someone from Cele switches places with Amber. I wonder how that first vote goes.
On that's a lot of things there. End of the day, they didn't want to get called out for playing favorites.
I mean, Natalie and Jeremy are on the same tribe. I feel like that's as close as you can get to Boston Rob and Amber.
Yeah. Yeah. And then so but here is where I was referencing the negative side of the social game on Edge of Extinction with Natalie, where she spends a lot of time with these players, and where Chris was like, you know, doing good social things and like, you know, being a provider and making the most of his time, Natalie, I think, was really kind of bothering people. Like, I know Yule for sure has talked about how Natalie was not pleasant to live with on Edge of Extinction, and you know, some others probably felt the same way. And the votes that she does get are from Jeremy, her friend, Tyson, I guess also her friend,
who likes her more than
came back into the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also Tyson has said he voted for Natalie because he liked Natalie the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, am I going to vote
outside the game?
Yeah. Am I going to vote for somebody who like I played with for a week, or am I going to vote for somebody who I spent a lot of time with and really bonded mm-hmm. with? And that's where the dynamic of Edge of Extinction comes into play here. Now, none of that has anything to do with Amber, but I don't know. I think it's more Natalie setting the tone for herself, which is an odd thing to say. But I think that is more of what dictates the vote here, where the person returning ends up losing because of their time on Edge of Extinction.
I think Amber plays a bigger context into this than we like to give credit for, because I think she gets overshadowed by Rumble a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to hear it. I'm curious.
And I think, well, one of the things we do know is that Amber and Rob were one of the like big push, like the big people on the edge pushing the fact that Natalie had to follow a blueprint in order to be considered mm-hmm. to win. And is a lot of the reason why Michelle doesn't get votes in this final tribal council is because they were very adamant that like, we have to make sure Natalie doesn't win. She didn't follow this blueprint. She didn't mm-hmm. do what she needed to do to get to the end of the game. She decided to play safe and she lost because of it. Yeah. So I think it is actually really important. And I think it's actually the fact that Amber becomes two jury votes is also really important. I think that, and we're not just talking like, yes, Amber isn't the most vocal person in the world. Boston Rob is mm-hmm. one yeah. of the most vocal people in the world. So having him there as, and being combined with him, right? Yes. They are two loved ones playing this game together, but they're also two loved ones working this vote together. And they both have, the thing is like they have the same social circle when it comes to this game because they're right. married. They literally know the exact same people. They interact with the exact same people. Sure, Rob might be closer with some of them. Amber might be closer with some of them, but they talk to the same people. They came from the same era of the show, right? Yep. So I don't think there is, it's really fair separating them, but at the same time, I don't think it's fair saying Amber has no control over this, because I think her being there in a pair on the Edge of Extinction actually does dictate a lot of this game and makes it so that there's a lot more weight in her actual opinion of, hey, Natalie was told how to win and she didn't do it. And it does actually impact the end of this game.
We all know who wears the pants in the relationship between Austin, Rob, and Amber. Yeah, and Amber. So, you know, Amber and Boston Rob talk, and then Boston Rob is just that mouthpiece too. That well, Rob gives more vocal.
He gives her a lot of credit for various things. Like in All Stars, he gives her more credit than what the fans do, and he makes sure that she gets that respect. And, you know, in life and then probably here, you know, he really lets it be known that Amber is like a really big influence and has a big say, even though, like you said, Boston Rob is the mouthpiece. So you don't see that as much.
I cry like, every time with the Edge of Extinction returnee moment where yeah. or the final challenge in the finale where Amber is like, OK, you know, everybody thought this guy over here deserved it. I came out here for him, but you know, I never thought I could win. And then Boston Rob just chimes in like, this is the toughest woman I know, and she stayed out here this entire time, made rice for everybody, never complained. This woman, that's a champion. And it speaks to, you know, her character on the edge, where she is that mother role of like, okay, you know, I'll make rice for everybody. I'm going to do what I have to do to make it through this game. And that can lead to, you know, lending people's ear a little bit more of like, Amber's really nice. Maybe I, you know, listen to what she thinks, who she thinks might, you know, be a deserving winner for the game. She's treated me really well here on the edge because, you know, she's made it her home for the entire time, basically.
I'm very curious, though, because, like, we'll never know a world with a different scenario here. We're never going to see Amber play again. We're never going to see Amber and Rob play together again if Rob were to ever play again. Mm-hmm. I know he's retired, but...
Yeah.
You can come back for 50. That's saying something.
That's true.
I get it. But in a world, let's say Natalie pulls the Chris Underwood, mm-hmm. does every single thing on the checklist that the people give. But you go to tribal council, and one of the things Rob makes very clear to Natalie is like, why did you isolate basically like the old schoolers, essentially? Why'd you isolate Amber? Why'd you isolate Yule? Why did you isolate Ethan? Ethan doesn't care. Ethan ends up voting for her. But I wonder in a world where like Natalie does cross all the T's and like, so Bots and Rob then decides that because you took out Tony, you win. Mm-hmm. Natalie, does Amber follow suit and vote Natalie? Or is she justifiably, in that sense, bitter towards Natalie? And, like, I can't vote for her because I don't like how she treated me on the edge. We'll never know because then the options become Sarah or Michelle here. Mm-hmm. But then that also creates a whole other vacuum of, do you have, like, the Wendell, Adam, and Nick? Are they pushing harder for Michelle to get all the votes to ensure that Natalie doesn't win? Because mm-hmm. they were the ones, not the old schoolers, that were very vocal of, we need to ensure that Natalie does not win this game. We would prefer to vote for Michelle, but we fear if we vote for Michelle, enough people are going to vote for Natalie in the split, and she wins based off plurality.
Right.
Yeah.
Does it now become a Michelle versus Natalie with Sarah there with a couple votes from Denise and Ben, and we get a different outcome entirely?
I think this really goes back to what I was saying about the edge of extinction, right? Like, the edge is a tribe. And you have to treat it like a tribe. And I don't think Natalie was treating it like a tribe.
Yeah.
She was,
Amber was playing that provider role and, you know, is able to, you know, work the rest of her jurors if need be.
Mm-hmm. And what it comes down to is, like, Natalie was treating this as Ponderosa, not as a tribe. And because of that, her social game stunk.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, yeah, okay, you're not meeting the outlast quota of Survivor, except like you're outlasting in a different way when you're on the edge of extinction, because God, that looks miserable. Especially in this season with what they were having them do and everything.
Yeah.
Like the logs and the coconuts and all that. Like a lot of running back and forth on the edge of extinction with one cup of rice all day.
Yeah.
But what I think this really comes down to is the fact that Amber as a juror values that social connection. And it's like, when you look back at Amber's win, I mean, she was young, right? She was young and she doesn't have these maternal instincts that she has in Edge of Extinction or in Winners at War on the Edge of Extinction. And I think like you really see the evolution of Amber from season 8 to season 40. And you see like, you know, as much as like she gets voted out for like being connected to Rob, and she had some time there. So, like, she could have done some damage this season. Because I think she could have easily have worked her way in socially, because she does have this very likable personality. And, like, she had a likable personality in All-Stars, but she kind of had, like, a little bit of that, like, mean girl aspect that she had in Australia still.
But not as much. Right? She learned each season.
Exactly. And, like, by the time we get to Winners at War, she is... it's so confusing. The Edge of Extinction's in this season.
It's the Edge of War. Yeah.
Exactly. But in Winners at War, like, you see that complete evolution of Amber, and I think that really does apply to this. And I think because of that evolution, that is why she's so adamantly against Natalie. And then because, like, I think if almost anyone else comes back from the Edge of Extinction, Amber probably feels more compelled to vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make a bolder take?
Sure.
Go for it.
In a world where Amber comes back from the Edge, We are talking about two-time winner Amber Burkitt.
I don't think that's a bold take. I think that is a bold part of that take
is that she would have any desire to win that challenge to come back.
It just falls on her lap, and like obviously there's a lot of things that would have to go right for her to end up in that final three, because Tony's not dumb, Sarah's not dumb. They just yeeted her right back out. But in a row where she gets there, she plays a better Chris Underwood game.
Uh-huh, 100%. I actually, which is crazy. Not to make this about Chris Underwood again, but I think Natalie losing here actually does prop up Chris's game quite a bit.
Yeah.
How necessary it is to play well on the edge of extinction.
Yeah.
And I also think that we're talking about Amber's growth arc through her seasons. And, you know, which finalist is most like me, Tony's growth arc through all of his seasons, that could be something that, you know, she connects to as well, because he had to adapt to his gameplay, where Amber didn't necessarily adapt gameplay, but, you know, she's just grown as a person from the last time she played. And I think, you know, that could have resonated with Tony as well.
Here's another thing.
Go ahead.
Rock, paper, scissors.
This is winners at war, right? Like, this is an all winners season. And I think if you're going to vote for someone who was voted out and came back into the game, like, you need to have a spotless resume. Like, it needs to be so strong. And when you're sitting next to someone like Tony, who absolutely represents the winners at war, in every way, it's for the same reason why I think everybody voted for Chris on Edge of Extinction is for the same reason why they don't vote for Natalie here, is that it's like, we want somebody from Edge of Extinction to represent our season. When you're on Edge of Extinction, we're on Winners at War. We want the best winner to represent our season. So is it impossible that someone who came back couldn't have won? Like, no, but it was going to be extremely difficult no matter who it was because of the season.
Because you had to put it up against Tony or Sarah at the end.
Good luck.
And Michelle, we shouldn't discount this final four.
Michelle has so many friends and social game.
When you get the final four, it's like, in a world where even, let's say Natalie wasn't voted out, we know what Natalie's game is like. That's a very impressive style of player. Tony is a very impressive style player. Sarah was basically repeating game changers and was getting away with it. Like, that's insane. Michelle, only winner to get to the end in both tries, never being voted out, and that being her only seasons. Yeah. Like, obviously Sandra, and the other two get medically evacuated or quit before they have a chance to. So it's like, Michelle's game obviously gets zero votes, deserves a lot more. I thought in real time when I was watching this, like, I knew Tony was winning, but I thought there was a world where an Amber sees her, like a younger version of her in Michelle, and would have given Michelle her vote, because like we've been saying throughout all the series, it's like, you end up picking people that are your avatars in the final three. And I feel like Michelle most reflects Amber's avatar of this person who has been an underestimated woman who should never have been underestimated, because we know how lethal a killer social game can be, and just being nice to people.
We needed to talk more to each other of being Amber, don't you see yourself in Michelle? And Arvidy had a great relationship with Michelle on the beach. Yeah. Boston Rob has that influential conversation with Michelle. Like, why didn't they talk more?
But you could have made an argument there. You could have made an argument about the styles of play. And Tony also gets the benefit of the doubt of having people. Parvati says it during the final tribal council of you sent so many of these people out of this game, and almost all of them almost come back and being like, I, of all the people I feel bitter at, I don't with Tony. I get it. Yeah. And that goes to Tony's credit for how incredible he did, where even in a world where Rob and some of the old schoolers potentially would have voted for Natalie if Natalie didn't isolate them and then played the perfect game. Mm-hmm. That also means Tony isn't there, but still, it's you get these credits from people from over multiple eras of the show being like, we have to give this man credit because we all wanted him out. We all wanted him out first if it was up to us. And he was able to outmaneuver, outplay us, did not have to go to the edge, got extorted by the edge by someone in the final three and is still here.
Yeah.
So no matter how great Natalie did coming back, this is a weird thing where like she absolutely needed to ensure that Tony was out. And once you don't take Tony out, you lose that credit with an Amber and a Rob and a Danny and a Yule.
Yeah.
And suddenly that now becomes why Tony wins.
Mm-hmm. Well, that has been our show, everybody.
Better, by the way. Better.
Better.
Better. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So next week we will be talking about the new era officially, and we are going to go with 41 through 45. So tune in next week for another episode of Bitter or Better. John, Specialist Universe.
Like the video, subscribe to the channel. We have stuff coming out tomorrow. Phil and Once Upon an Island will be breaking down their the winners that we just discussed from these five seasons. So that'll be all the people that we talked about today.
Yep.
Except for the So that'll be interesting if you want to listen to Phil just like dunk on Chris Underwood and demonstrate that he doesn't understand Chris Underwood is actually kind of good at the game. You can do that. Then on Sunday, that's right, Sunday, the top 10 of the winner ranking will come out. Should be very interesting. It's an interesting crop that remains in that top 10. So it should be interesting to see how bad the Wilgorithm messes everything up.
Yeah.
Join us over on the Patreon, like become a patron, join the Patreon. Every Season Matters is doing Game Changers right now. Kind of dunked on it a little bit earlier, but interesting season to discuss nonetheless. And that's about it, and we'll be right back here next week for that new era episode.
All right, everybody, see you next week. Goodbye.